on his face. Getting away just became immensely easier. Grisham and I continue into the neon Bible. The crush of people inside is harrowing. Firstborns grind against one another on tiered dance floors. Some dance above the crowd using hover discs. We're shown to a higher, more private deck several levels up. The music here is muted, but I can still watch the action below from the railing. All the men on this floor are in evening attire. Very few women are about. My attention is drawn to the dangerous men in the room, most with fusion blades and fusion mags from Salloway's arsenals. Grisham begins greeting the men. I recognize Valdi Schelling's associate, Padar. I know him as Firstborn Albatross, the sword-fated man who groped me during an arms deal with Clifton almost a year ago. He appears to be the proprietor of the Neon Bible. Padar notices me almost immediately. Although he's a smaller man than Valdi, he still cuts a brutally large figure. His dark hair is slicked back and well-oiled. In his late 30s, he looks like he could bend steel with his bare hands. So it's ironic when he has the same reaction I did upon seeing him. The strong man cringes a little. I nod to him in acknowledgement of the awkwardness. Padar turns to the nearest member of his staff and says, "Get our guests anything they want, on the house." Grisham practically cackles. He rubs his hands together in anticipation and orders a death defier. When the drink arrives, it's black, with swirls of milky white liquid resembling a skull and crossbones. Grisham stirs it with a long spoon and drinks it in one gulp. He wheezes a little, handing the glass and spoon back to the waiter, and walks toward the nearby holographic displays running commentary on the competitors and the trials. His security entourage follows. Padar's gray eyes catch mine again. He approaches and says quietly, "I never had the opportunity to apologize to you. I was gravely out of line." I lift my chin a notch, meeting his gaze. "All will be forgiven if you do me a small favor." He smiles slowly. "You have but to ask." I need to slip away for a moment, to run an errand. No one with me can know I've gone until I'm away. A firstborn star will join us shortly. I need him to receive a private message. Padar eyes the two hovering halo stingers behind me with a dubious look. "Don't worry about them," I tell him. "They're not a problem." Padar's eyebrows rise, but he says nothing. He lifts his hand, and another burly man comes forward and listens as Padar whispers something in his ear. The man nods, turns to yet another man farther away, and says, "Get Kristoff." A 10-year-old second-born boy is brought forward. He's a sword, made from Padar's mold. Dark hair hangs in his face, and he has broad shoulders already. The young second-born comes forward and stops in front of Padar. Padar leans down and whispers something in the boy's ear. He nods, sizing me up. "Ready?" he asks. "We'll distract the exos for you," Padar says. "You will be taken out the back way." He makes no move toward me, maybe having learned his lesson from our previous encounter. Then he nods his head, and suddenly a fight breaks out on the dance floor below. People brawling and throwing punches. The noise and chaos is deafening. Everyone rushes to the railings to watch. Grisham is enthralled. "Thank you, Padar," I murmur. "All is forgiven." Kristoff's sword moves toward the back of the club, with me on his heels. We escape through a secret door in the wall and down some back stairs. My halo stingers still follow me closely. When we get to the bottom of the stairs, Kristoff dismisses the guards on duty there. They turn and go, as if he's the boss. He opens the door that leads outside. I turn to the hovering black hardware behind us and rattle off the stinger code that Clifton gave me. R0517 and R6492 return to the Halo Palace. They hesitate. My heart beats hard in my chest. The boy beside me watches the heavily armed stingers with suspicion. Then, as if they finally recognize the command, they fly past us, out into the night sky, and disappear into the darkness. With the machines gone, it feels as if a weight has been lifted from me. From the hollowed-out heel of my boot, I extract a black fingerless glove and a small piece of lead. I cover my moniker with them. The silver sword goes dark. I take out the looking-glass moniker and turn it on before slipping the bracelet onto my wrist. It reflects Kristoff's moniker beside me. He watches everything I do. "What's your message, and who do I give it to?" he asks. "Find Raiken Winterstrom," I reply, and then describe him. "He'll come to the Neon Bible. Tell him to cover for me. Tell him I will meet him back at the Halo Palace tonight."
"That's all?"
"Yes."
"The boss says you need cover to blend in," Kristoff mutters.
"I do," I reply. I use the hood of my jacket, pulling it over my hair and as low on my forehead as I can.
"This way," Kristoff says, taking my hand.
It's strange, being led around by a 10-year-old boy who acts like a 30-year-old man. Not that I expected him to act like a child. He's not firstborn.
"Are you Padar's son?" I ask as we maneuver through the frolicking crowd, which grows louder and bawdier by the minute. I try to keep my chin down.
"Might be," he replies with a stoic expression, "but he ain't saying, and I ain't asking. The one they says was my father is dead, killed by the Gates of Dawn. But I heard he was just someone who couldn't pay what he owed."
I wonder about how Padar operates. If someone fell into debt with the Firstborn Sword, that person might have to do whatever was demanded of him to get out of it. Maybe even marry and pretend his wife's children are his. Kristoff bears such a resemblance to Padar that I could see that.
We approach a street vendor selling holographic masks. They shine and blink on a hovering wire rack in the front of the pavilion. The vendor takes one look at Kristoff, recognition dawns, and he quickly looks the other way, as if he's afraid of the boy. I stare at the masks on display. Some mimic wildlife, elephants with long gray trunks made of light, swine with triangular ears and round snouts, wolves with long muzzles and sharp teeth. Others suggest eerie monsters with viper fangs or mouthless beasts. Kristoff chooses a black panther mask with black triangular ears, long whiskers, and yellow eyes. He hands it to me.
"That's you for sure," he says. "A cat."
Lifting it to my face, I pull the strap over my hair and tug my cowl down once more. Unable to help myself, I touch his cheek.
"You take care, Kristoff."
"You too, St. Sismode."
Why he chooses to call me by my old last name, I don't know. But I have no time to wonder. I set a brisk pace to the news hover van before Franklin Starr leaves without me. The news van has a big, bold, blue holographic iris surrounding a black pupil on its side. Every few seconds, the eyelid blinks and the iris changes color. Beside the eye, a sandy-haired secondborn paces, consulting his shooting star-shaped moniker. Crowds of people jostle past him on their way to different party venues. Sidling up to the secondborn, I murmur, "Franklin?" A scared scowl crosses his face, and his glasses go askew when he jolts. He rearranges them on his nose. Grasping his heart, he tries to see me beyond the hologram of my mask.
"Who sent you?" he whispers.
His thin body leans closer to me.
"Belmora," I reply.
He looks around, deciding whether we're being watched. Finding no one, Franklin gestures to the side with his head, motioning to the hover van's sliding side panel. He ushers me inside and closes the door. In the dark, the smell of stale beer assaults me. My eyes adjust to the dimness. One side of the van is a command center. The other has metal racks bolted to the floor. Inside mesh bins, drone cameras lie charging, their green-spotted lens eyes seeming to stare into my soul. A workstation is next to the drones. It has a couple seats, folded away. I sit down on the dingy steel floor toward the rear of the vehicle. Franklin gets into the driver's seat. Over his shoulder, he says,
"If we get caught, I'd appreciate you saying that you stowed away in here without me knowing."
"Sure, Franklin," I agree.
"Keep your head down."
He starts the hover van.
With a low rumble and a sway of the hulking van, we're off. Wires on hooks jumble around. Equipment I have no name for rubs against other equipment I have no name for. I lie on the cold, dingy floor and stare up. Moonlight glints through the dirty window. We're not stopped or checked as we exit the trial village. No one seems overly concerned that we're leaving. Franklin attempts to make small talk, but beyond confirming that I want to go to Club Faraway, I ignore his questions. After a few minutes, he gives up and focuses on the route. It's not until this moment that I allow myself to unleash what I've stuffed down deep inside since agreeing to do this. Goosebumps prickle over my skin. Fear grabs me by the throat. This could be a setup. Even if it's not, I'm not optimistic that I'll make it out of this alive. I'm about to storm into a drug den and attempt to kidnap my firstborn brother, the heir to the deadliest fate in the world. I could paint this as a selfless act, wax poetic about how noble it is to save Gabriel and reunite him with the love of his life, but that's not why I'm doing it. If I'm being honest with myself, I'm terrified of Gabriel dying and forcing me to take his place. Othala will never forgive me. Not that I care, I tell myself, even as shame burns my cheeks. But there's more to it than that. If Gabriel dies and I become firstborn, I'll be something I've come to despise. If I'm required to take over, there are no guarantees that I won't be worse than Gabriel. I'm significantly more vicious, and I know this about myself. If I become firstborn, any faction seeking to destroy me or attempt to wrestle away my power would be met with ruthless retaliation, just like my mother's. Othala and I will never again be on the same side. The problem is, if I can't maintain power, the odds of me descending into some nightmarish prison of Othala's or Bowie's or even Crow's making is high. If Othala is aligned with Crow, I can include soul-crushing torture. But the final reason that I welcome this fight tonight is because it may be my one shot at having a family again. I had love, a makeshift family, but I've lost it, and there's a gaping hole in my heart where it used to be. I need to be honest with myself. Hawthorne isn't coming back. He's going to go on with his life. His firstborn life. He would have contacted me by now if he planned to be a part of the rebellion, or to see me. It's been weeks. He knows where I am. He also knows the odds are against our fixing anything. We have a better chance of making things worse. Saving Gabriel could be my only shot at happiness. If Belmora, the secondborn of the Fate of Virtues, and Gabriel, the firstborn of the Fate of Swords, can unite and fight for change, then maybe there's a better world ahead for all of us. Maybe together, they can bring us peace. Chapter 15, The Consolation of Oblivion. Franklin stops the hover van on the street corner one block from Club Faraway. Before I even close the door, he speeds away. Taking off the cat mask, I toss it into a garbage receptacle. The streets aren't very crowded in downtown Purity. The upscale metropolitan area is more office building than residential. Slowly, I follow the navigation on my wrist communicator. "I'm approaching the club," I whisper into the device. "Have you located a weapon?" "Go look under the bench in front of the Mechadome Clinic," Belmora replies through the communicator. I spot the hovering bench in front of a Mechadome storefront. Different types of bots are on display. None of them resemble Phoenix. Attached to the bottom of the seat bench, I find a generic fusion blade, tear it away from the adhesive, and strap the thigh sheath to my right leg. "Got it," I mutter into the communicator. "Good. You're clear to go." "Copy." I tighten the belt of the long black jacket that Clifton's team made for me. My hand smooths down the copper scale. I hope it's as good as Clifton claims, or I'm dead. The navigation points to a posh, fin-shaped skyscraper. The outside of the slender building resembles gray shark skin. It's intriguing without being overt. Club Faraway is nestled on the corner, next to other elegant facades of what appear to be average-looking office buildings. The drug lair doesn't overtly advertise. No signs. No patrons milling around outside. Balconies speckle the side of the building, reminiscent of an elegant hotel. The rooftop has a penthouse at the peak of the dorsal fin. At street level, glass doors filled with undulating blue water blur the view inside. Pushing one open, I take a cautious step in. The door closes behind me. Bright light from the ceiling and the floor make it hard to see. Security traps me in the vestibule between the outer and inner doors. I'm in a faux tank, the walls all filled with water, blurring everything on the outside. "This is a weapons-free zone," an automated feminine voice sounds. "Please check all weapons in the receptacle." A silver cylindrical apparatus rises from the floor, and a round chute opens inside it. My heart sinks. I have to give up my weapon if I want to get in. I consider leaving, but if I do, I'll always ask, what if? Reluctantly, I pull the fusion blade from the sheath on my thigh and deposit it in the receptacle. The weapon disappears, and an orange plastic disc emerges. I place it in my pocket. The bright light fades. The doors slide open. The pristine lobby is dimly lit. The floor shines with wavering aquamarine light, like sunshine filtering through water. Softly lit chandeliers barely push back the shadows. Clusters of dark velvet chairs with high seat backs float above the floor. I gaze around for elevators, hallways, or other attached rooms. There aren't any. For a drug club, it isn't attracting any customers. Soft instrumental music plays. A woman with thick dark glasses sits in the corner facing the door. Her hair is white, with blunt-cut bangs in the front. A fat tumbler of amber liquid rests on the table beside her. A rose-colored cigar sends a curl of fragrant pink smoke up from her ashtray. A glove masks her moniker. On the opposite side of the room sits a thin, well-built man. He's hollow-cheeked and dressed as if for the opera, drinking a wine spritzer. I don't judge. Wine spritzers are delicious. A clerk, middle-aged, a virtue-faded second-born with slicked-back hair and a dark suit with a high collar, stands at a blue wave-shaped desk at the back of the room. The wall behind it is a shark tank. Holographic screens in the desk cast hieroglyphic symbols up onto the clerk's face. "Hello, and welcome to Club Faraway." The second-born smiles. His teeth glint. His glittering diamond ascot pin twinkles. "Do you have a reservation, or are you here to meet a party?" "A party," I say. "Solomon Sunday." His nostrils flare, and his finger hesitates on the virtual screen. He has been expecting me. "Firstborn Sunday is..." His eyes widen in terror. I duck. The clerk's neck and jaw explode from a fusion mag shot, spattering brain matter onto the tank behind him. I don't look back, but jump over the desk. A second fusion mag blast strikes me in the back between my shoulder blades. Judging by the angle, the shot had to have come from the wine spritzer man. The copper scale of my coat absorbs part of it, but the impact is like being hit by a speeding hovercraft. I slam into the shark tank and slide to the floor. The clerk's corpse twitches beneath me. I wheeze. My lungs feel turned inside out. Flecks of the clerk's blood mar his diamond tie pin. I pluck the tie pin from the cloth. Footsteps draw nearer. Ignoring the pain, I lurch up and throw the tie pin at the man who shot me. The needle and diamond slice into his pupil. Wine spritzer screams and holds his hand to his bloody eye. I reach across the desk, grasp his other hand, and turn his fusion mag. We shoot at the white-haired assassin stalking toward us, but she dives to the floor. I twist the fusion mag in Wine Spritzer's hand again and shoot him through the chin with it, blowing off the top of his head. As he crumbles, I tear the weapon from his hand. The woman on the floor fires again. The pulse hits my right bicep. My jacket absorbs most of the pulse, but it still knocks me off my feet. My fingers go numb. I can't hold on to the fusion mag, and it drops to the floor and slides. Straightening, I reach for it with my left hand.
The woman walks around the desk, and her perfect cherry lips gape open when she sees I'm not dead. My fusion pulse blows her shattered heart out of her chest. She flies backward and hits the ground, bouncing. I stagger to my feet as the numbness in my arm gives way to aching tingles. It still works, but it aches like hell. Moving my fingers to get the feeling back into them, I search wine spritzer with my other hand. A spade-like knife is concealed in a leg sheath. He was waiting for me. Whoever planted the assassins in the lobby knew I was coming, or someone like me. I remove his glove. No moniker, but a scar where it used to be. I move to the woman. Her hair is a wig, and when I pull it away, she's bald. Gruesome scars cover her scalp. I pluck the dark glasses from her face. Brown eyes with a silver tint stare up, unseeing. I don her glasses and wig, stuffing my long brown strands beneath it. I untie her rose-colored scarf, wrap it around my throat and the lower half of my face, and remove her glove. She doesn't have a moniker either. It was cut out. I take her fusion mag and shove it in my pocket. Back at the clerk's desk, I use the spade knife to cut out his second-born moniker, stuffing it inside my glove so that it shines through the mesh. Then I use the holographic screens above the desk to find Gabriel. He's registered in the penthouse suite. I do another search. Solomon Sunday is registered to a suite on the 8th floor, the Euphoria room. Maybe it wasn't Balmora who set me up. Maybe Gabriel is here after all. Maybe my mother knew someone might come to kill him, now that he's in Virtues, and set a trap here and in the penthouse. The wall behind me slides sideways. Straightening in surprise, I realize that the wall was merely a holographic illusion. An entryway to a drug den lies open. Everything inside is red. Huge, round, ruby-colored lanterns hang from the ceiling. It's like a multi-level casino, but instead of gaming tables and machines, there are tall, transparent cylinders containing bodies. The bodies are suspended behind the glass. Some are alone in their tubes and simply float like dreamy fetuses in wombs. Others are suspended together in massive glass cylinders, entangling each other in orgies of passion. Decadent crimson furniture surrounds some of the glass tubes, occupied by firstborns watching the haze of smoke and naked bodies. People walk the floor like zombies, with pallid skin and unbalanced gaits. A virtue-faded firstborn with bloodshot eyes stops in his tracks next to me. He's stooped and unsteady on his feet. "Is this real?" he asks. "No," I reply, making my way into the red poppy haze. The wall slides shut behind me, hiding the lobby. Serpentine clouds of red smoke hang in the air. The scent spins my head in lazy circles, even through my scarf. Red banners hang, curling and floating, from beams above, blooming like poppies, opening and closing, opening and closing. A young boy, maybe 8, takes my hand. Wordlessly, he leads me to a jewel-red counter where a secondborn, wearing a mask with a painted poppy over her nose and mouth, dispenses a menagerie of mind-altering substances from behind glass. Holographic menus display on the glass. "Do you have aerosol?" I ask the moon-faded attendant. "Something that will make me sleepy?" She languidly twists pieces of her garnet-colored hair around her finger. "Of course. Hazy Days 99. She holds up a cylindrical can and depresses a button on top of it. The aerosol mists in a short burst. The arch of it forms a rainbow. It doesn't seem to affect her. "How many?" "Everything you have, and a mask like yours." Her eyes bug out. "Do you want that on a hover cart?" "Yes." "Scan your moniker," she says. I scan the clerk's moniker as she loads a few dozen aerosols into a hover cart. The cart passes through to me. "Do you know where the lifts are?" I ask the little second-born boy at my side. He nods, calls the lift with his moniker, and tugs my hand. As we walk to the lift, I ask, "What's your name?" He shrugs lethargically. I make a mental note to come back for him when I have the power to change his life by rescuing him from this awful place. I enter the lift alone and wait for the doors to close. Then, opening the lid of the hover cart, I take out several cans and place them on the floor. I slip the mask over my nose and mouth and wrap it with the scarf. I lift a can and spray the cameras in the elevator, puncture several other cans in the hover cart, and close the lid. The dial on the hover cart is set to follow mode. I reset it to propel mode. The hover cart hits the doors and grinds against them. Positioning the clerk's moniker beneath the scanner, I select the 8th floor. The elevator rises. I lean back into the corner where the walls of the elevator meet. I lift one foot and place it on one wall. My other foot pushes against the other wall. With my feet on each of the 2 corner walls, I use the leverage to scale them and press myself against the ceiling near the doors. When the car stops and opens, armed guards are waiting, their fusion mags drawn. The hover cart idles forward. One of the guards opens it. An aerosol cloud wafts out, their shoulders round, and their arms grow heavy. Thumps resound as the guards topple over. Someone calls, "What is it?" I drop down from the ceiling. A guard glances at me and smiles dopily. "Adriana," he murmurs. He must think I'm the female assassin from the lobby. He slumps against the wall and slides down it. Sounds of pounding feet grow near. I puncture more cans and toss them into the hallway. Billowing fog fills the air. Feet slow. Bodies hit the floor. When the fog clears, I peek my head out and draw it back fast. A dozen guards sit limply against the walls. Some lie on the floor, weapons fallen haphazardly beside them. It's rainbow fields forever out there. Following the trail of bodies, I reach the door at the end of the corridor. No sounds come from the other side. Pulling out my fusion mag, I aim it at the door, and then, on second thought, I hide the weapon behind my back and knock. The door opens partway. "You're supposed to be in the lobby," a tall, burly man says. I kick in the door. He stumbles back, drawing his fusion mag. I shoot him in the chest. His colleagues are gathered around a virtual screen watching a pre-trial training session. They draw weapons. I lift my fusion mag and pull the trigger in rapid succession. Bodies twist and fall like discarded puppets. I should feel bad, but I don't. If I were here to kill Gabriel, they wouldn't have stopped me because they were too busy entertaining themselves. I bar the door and cautiously creep to the main apartment. It's empty. In the master bedroom, I find Gabriel alone, passed out on the bed. His dark hair is in disarray. Cadaverous eyes rimmed in dark circles sit atop his hollowed cheeks. His elegant silk shirt is open, revealing a sunken chest. His rolled-up sleeves reveal scabs and bruises. He trembles. He's either done too much or not enough. I tug the scarf and mask from my face. "Gabriel," I whisper. Tears prickle my eyes. I touch his shoulder and try to rouse him. He finally opens his eyes and squints at me. "Who are you?" he whispers. I pull off the white wig and glasses. "Fabriana Friday," I murmur through my tears. "Are you here to save the world?" he asks weakly. It's something he would have said when we were kids. "I'm here to rescue you, Solomon Sunday." I touch his hair. It's brittle. He doesn't reply, just continues to tremble. I speak into the wrist communicator. "I have him, Belmora. I need a super-fast airship." "You're getting a delivery hover." Belmora's voice rings through the wrist communicator. "Creamy Krellas, side alley, below your position. Can you get there now?" "We'll get there." The extra glove and leaded swatch I brought with me slide easily over Gabriel's left hand, blotting out his moniker. I roll my brother onto his side and then reach for his belt, sliding it from the loops of his trousers. Undoing my own belt, I hook them together. I thread the long belt behind Gabriel's waist. Lying next to him like a spoon so that my back is pressed against his chest, I secure the belt around my waist so he's strapped to my back. Reaching behind me, I lift his arms and hoist them over my shoulders. The bruises on my back and chest ache. So does my arm, but I ignore the pain. When I stand, Gabriel comes with me, his dead weight distributed to my shoulders and back. Hunching over, I carry him to the empty balcony. We inch out onto it, and then I lean Gabriel against the wall, holding him there with my back against his chest. I pluck the clerk's moniker from my glove and drop it on the balcony. I peel back the glove covering my moniker, and then you spring up from the silver sword. I may not be able to communicate with it, but I can activate the hover discs on the bottoms of my boots. I program them for rapid descent and smooth my glove over my moniker again. I clutch Gabriel's arms. He isn't very heavy, but it's awkward to move with him on my back. Disregarding gracefulness, I climb over the railing of the balcony and leap off. The cool wind whistling past my ears deadens the shouts from the henchmen on the rooftop. They don't shoot, probably because Gabriel is shielding me. A few of them jump from the peak of the dorsal fin. My brother doesn't move. He's barely conscious. Near the ground, the hover discs activate and slow our fall. When I halt just above the sidewalk, inertia makes it feel as if my kneecaps will explode. Wincing, I look around for the alley. Sinister figures using gravitators land on the avenue behind us. Black clad, they hold rifles that could blow holes through Gabriel and me. But none of them fires. They pause, speaking into their monikers. I use my hover discs to skate in the opposite direction. They pursue us, but they're on foot, so they fall behind. Rounding a corner, I nearly run into a hovering delivery craft idling in the alleyway. Animated characters made to look like Krellas dance in a three-dimensional display of jouncing revelry around the perimeter of the hover truck. Krella creatures bathe in chocolate streams that morph into showers of glaze and sprinkles. For a second, I think I must have been sprayed by Hazy Days 99, because this is my biggest fantasy. But then a man with a thick unibrow and a double chin calls to me through the window of the hover truck. "Get in!" He points his thumb to the rear of the vehicle. The truck lurches forward, picking up speed as it moves through the alley. "No," I whimper. The back door of the craft slides open. I force my legs to move, skating behind it, my thighs burning. The holographic Krella creatures wave banners and march next to me. Clenching my teeth, I lurch for the opening. As we dive through the doorway, the driver triggers the hatch and it falls closed, hiding us within. Small lights near the floor illuminate the inside of the hover truck. Steel racks of ice-cream-filled Krellas line the walls to the ceiling. In the truck's crisp refrigeration, I lay on the floor beside Gabriel, our breath huffing in white wisps. I can't tell if my brother shakes from the cold or from detoxification. The belts cut into my flesh. Unhooking the clasp, I free us from them. Gabriel tumbles away, curling into a ball on the floor. "Gabriel, are you okay?" I ask. "Where am I?" he whispers. "You're in a hover truck. I'm taking you to Balmora." His forearms are so thin it makes me want to cry.
"Should let me die," he says between clenched teeth.
My heart throbs painfully. "I'm not letting you die." Peeling off my jacket, I lay it over him. We take a corner, and Gabriel rolls across the floor. I lift his head, stabilizing him against my shoulder. In my other hand, I hold a fusion mag pointed at the back of the hover truck, in case the guards catch up to us. I don't remember the last time I was this close to my brother. Maybe when he stopped my mother from killing me on my transition day? That's how it goes, though. The Fates Republic won't allow us to be a family. Using propaganda and their stupid hysteria-eliciting rhetoric to sow suspicion between siblings, casting doubt over second-born's intentions. Anger heats my face. A tear slips over my lashes. They should have left us alone as kids. Let us be each other's friend. Everybody always pointed out his golden sword instead, like it was the reason for him not to love me. But Gabriel loved me anyway, and it destroyed him. I can see that now. Tears like I've never allowed myself course down my face. The Fates Republic keeps selling us the biggest lie of all, that we're nothing to each other. Enemies. Now we're all just liars. My wrist communicator lights up.
Wiping tears and snot, I take a few seconds to answer it.
Do you have him? Is he okay?
Balmora's voice trembles. I take a deep breath and exhale. I have him. He's not okay. He's sick and frail.
Just get him here, she says with a shaky voice.
Soon the hover van comes to a stop. I wipe my face on my sleeve again and train the fusion mag on the door. It slides open.
Let's get this over with, Double Chin says. I'm late for my rounds.
He ignores my weapon and waves me out.
Move! We have a delivery barge ready to take you to Balmora at the Sea Fortress.
Two more men with Silver Sun monikers flank him. One of the men has scars on his face from burns that went untreated. Lowering the fusion mag, I allow the three bakers to help me with Gabriel. They hoist him up and carry him out. I take my jacket and hop down. We're on the waterfront. Tall white lights push back the darkness along the length of the pier. Sea air pushes at my hair. The bakers unload tall steel containers from the back of the hover truck. Two are empty.
Get in, the one with the burn scars grunts.
The other two bakers are already loading Gabriel inside a separate case. Harrowing fear blows through me. I'll be at their mercy if I get inside. The burned one reads my dubious expression.
You think we want you dead? He asks.
He's missing a few teeth and smells like bread. I shrug.
We don't want Grisham to be the virtue. We want one of us, a secondborn. We got nothing against you. You're secondborn. And anyway, Balmora says you're not to be harmed.
My options are limited, so I swallow my fear and step inside the hovering steel case.
You're going to have to give me your weapons and wrist communicator. The security scanners near the Halo Palace might pick them up.
Reluctantly, I hand over my communicator and all the arms I've collected.
Now lift your shirt, he says.
I stiffen. Why?
I have to put this on you.
He holds up a clear plastic swatch with silver wires running through it. What is that?
It mutes your heart, so no one can tell that anything inside the box is alive. The case will hide your body heat.
I lift my shirt, and he attaches the adhesive swatch over my heart.
Patty, you got some of them calico crellas?
The one with the oblong face and a beat-down expression nods and walks to the cab of the truck. He returns and hands a small satchel to his partner. The baker offers it to me. Inside, a couple of pastries sit wrapped in wax paper.
For the brave one, he says, and then shuts the door, locking me inside.
Darkness and a delicious fresh-baked crella scent assault me. The case floats forward amid muffled shouts. Unwrapping a crella, I bite into it, and I'm overtaken by the taste of cinnamon-flavored sunlight.
I should have been born into the fate of suns. If this is a last meal, it's a good one. Maybe the best one.
When the case finally opens, maybe an hour later, I inhale large gasps of fresh air and squint against the lamplight. I'm in a room that resembles the exposed belly of an ancient sea vessel. An enormous chandelier made of coral and sea glass hangs from wooden rafters. Its lights resemble white tapers, but they're actually fusion energy. Quincy holds the door for me. I brace my arm against the side of the case. My knees ache, but I rise and step down out of the crate. I stand inside a palatial bedroom with an archway to a stone terrace. Balmora's melodic voice says, "You're in the Fate of Seas Tower." Gabriel is sprawled on the floor with his head cradled in her lap. She strokes his damp hair.
My brother has been sick. Bile clings to his lips, which are a frightening shade of blue.
We need to get him to a bed.
Balmora's pleading eyes stare up at me. I kneel on one knee and hitch Gabriel's arm around my shoulders. Balmora does the same on his other side. We lift him up and drag him. His black boots skim across the carpet, kicking up dust motes. The bed isn't as musty. Its ornate frame is carved from real wood, which hasn't been done much for centuries. It's a pirate's bed, or at least that's what it seems like. Its four massive posts are carved dragon heads, resembling mastheads from sea ships that no longer exist. Someone has recently changed the bedding, and dust cloths have been removed from the furniture and left in a heap in the corner. We hoist Gabriel onto the mattress and rest his head against the plump pillows. "Where are your drones?" I ask Belmora. "Outside my bedroom in the Virtues Tower." She fusses over Gabriel, pulling his boots off, removing his shirt. "Why aren't they with you?" "I had a star-fated secondborn infiltrate them. A coded voice command from me will trick the drones into thinking I'm in my bedroom. Another will make them believe I'm in the gallery, and another that I'm in the media room. The exos who monitor me have grown bored and often just rely on the drones to keep track of me. And my attendants are afraid of me, so when I tell them I want to be alone, they're happy to leave me to myself. How do you go anywhere in this place without being seen?" She looks at me with an appraising stare. "My father's brother, Edward, the last secondborn commander, taught me the secrets of the sea fortress before he died. We lived here together for years, my uncle and me. He introduced me to the network of spies who helped you tonight." "I thought you had developed it on your own." Belmora's laughter contains little humor. "This network has existed for hundreds of years, passed on from secondborn to secondborn. You wouldn't know about it, of course. We always lack swords, because secondborn swords within a family are rarely able to communicate with one another. Take your uncle, Basil, your mother's brother. He was killed at 18, only a few weeks after his transition. He could hardly pass any information to you. You weren't even born. And the secondborn workers in the Sword Palace are terrified of your mother. They're not a good resource for our network. The risk of discovery is too great. It's not like that with other fates. We live much longer than secondborn swords. We work together. Sometimes live together." "Census doesn't know about it?" I ask. "Census infiltrates our network from time to time. We recently had a whole branch of our operatives sheared away in the Fate of Moons. Some were murdered. Some destroyed themselves to protect others. We're nearly blind there. Same within the Fate of Stars and Atoms. They've sided with the Gates of Dawn and cut us off. But we continue to groom operatives. Individual star and atom-fated secondborns who reside outside their fatedoms will sometimes work with us. In Virtues, I have hundreds of secondborns of all fates who have sworn loyalty to me." "What we need right now is a physician for Gabriel," I urge. "He'll have one, and Adam will be here soon." Quincy brings a bowl of water from the bathroom. Setting it on the table next to the bed, she wrings out a small cloth and hands it to Belmora, who uses it to bathe Gabriel. My brother opens his eyes when she washes his face. "Where am I?" he whispers. "Safe with me," Belmora assures him. He lifts his shaking hand, touching hers. "Told you not to come. Too late. Should've let me die." His voice is raspy and slurred. "You're not allowed to die," Belmora scolds in her bossiest tone. "Do you hear me?" "I can't stop her." "Who, Gabriel?" I ask, coming closer to the bed. "Who can't you stop?" I'm worried that he means me. "I don't want to hurt you." "I can't," Gabriel whispers. His eyes are now bleeding from their corners. "Only you can. Too many zeros." Is he delusional? Am I just part of his hallucination? "Who is she?" I ask him. "Mother? Are you talking about the sword, Gabriel?"
"Gabriel's dead."
His smile is tragic.
"Only Solomon Sundays left."
"You're Gabriel," I whisper.
"Gabriel's dead," he shouts, his voice higher but not actually louder. "Just let us die."
He struggles to sit up, but he's too weak. Belmora holds him down. His eyes flutter shut, and he pants for breath.
"You should go," Belmora says to me anxiously. "You're upsetting him, and I can't have exos looking for you here. I'll have Quincy show you the secret way out. Don't come back unless I call for you." Pearls of sweat shine on her upper lip.
Gabriel is still trembling, covered in sweat. I desperately want to stay with him, but I know I'd only put him in more danger. Belmora, you'll keep me updated on how he is? I ask. As best I can, she replies, rising from the bed to hug me. We cling to each other for a few moments, and then she lets me go. Thank you for bringing him to me. Quincy, help Roselle get back to shore. Use the sea gate and make sure no one sees her leave. Quincy nods. It's this way. She leads me to the stone balcony, where the wind tosses my hair, pushing it into my face. Stone griffins, frozen and mid-pounce, stare at me from above. Quincy climbs the protruding mortar of the tower like a monkey and pulls on the stone snout of the griffin, wrenching it to the side. A stone wall beside the tall column opens, showing the outline of a doorway. Quincy climbs down and pushes against the wall, and the opening grows larger. She disappears inside. I follow her. Her small fusion-powered light pushes back the darkness inside, allowing me to see past her into a cramped hallway about 3 feet wide and maybe 7 feet high. Push the door closed, Quincy says. I lean against it until it locks in place. Quincy turns away and walks farther into the stone hallway, a spiraling ramp down the outer wall of the tower. It's a dizzying journey. The walls are dry and rough, but the air is damp and has a faint scent of rotten fish that gets stronger during our long descent. At sea level, other passageways branch off. Quincy stops and turns, whispering, "This leads to the main hallway. Security for the fortress is nearby." She puts her fingers to her lips. I nod. We tiptoe farther down the spiraling stone ramp. The air grows damper. Sea urchins encrust the walls. At the bottom is a small landing and a deep pool of water. The sea gate is down there. Quincy points to the dark depths. You mean underwater? The last thing I want to do tonight is get wet. She nods and walks to a round wheel with handholds. Turning the wheel activates a pulley system, which raises an iron gate, drawing it up from the water. Are you a good swimmer? Quincy asks. Decent, I reply, tugging off my boots. Quincy opens a wooden box and pulls out a device that looks like a small torpedo with handlebars. She sets it down on the stone floor. Opening the front of it, she places my boots inside. Anything else you don't want to get wet? She asks. I shrug off my jacket and hand it to her. She folds it and places it neatly in the torpedo. This mask goes over your eyes and nose so you'll be able to breathe. There's a dim headlight that I've programmed to extinguish when you get close to shore. When you get to the beach, press this button to open the hatch. Remove your things, then press this button, and the underwater propulsion device will return to the fortress. Anything else? I ask. Watch out for sharks. My insides quail at the thought. The mask sits tight against my face, and the air activates before I ease into the water, holding the propulsion device with both hands. Sinking beneath the surface, the mask illuminates the opening to the sea ahead. The right handlebar has the throttle grip. Turning it slowly, I ease away from the stone fortress. The water is cold, but it's not unbearable. My legs drift as I circumvent rocks and reefs. Beautiful coral is alive with sea plants that sway in the current. As I near the Halo Palace, the water becomes shallower, and my chest and thighs bump against the sand. I let go of the throttle, and the waves push me gently toward the shore. I stand up and wade forward until I'm only waist deep. I collect my boots and coat from the niche, holding them above the water with one hand, then take off the mask and drop it inside before closing the compartment. Following Quincy's instructions, I press the button, and the vehicle submerges and jets away. Chapter 16. Carry These Bones. When I enter the foyer, my apartment is quiet and dark. Phoenix doesn't waddle in to greet me. I drop my boots by the door and wait, but it doesn't come. Maybe its hover mode malfunctioned?
I take one tentative step, and then another.
Fee?
I slip off my jacket and leave it on the small table. I have sand all over myself. I need to shower and sleep. Walking out of the foyer, I slow my steps. The lights don't come on automatically in the drawing room. The shutters are closed.
Lights,
I order. Nothing happens. I fumble for the lamp I know is on the small bureau near me. I touch it, and the soft glow barely pushes back the shadows. I move to the other lamp near it, but the shadow of a figure on the sofa in the drawing room captures my attention. Raikin. Seated on the middle cushion, the star is hunched over, his elbows resting on his thighs, his head bowed, his hands gripping the back of his skull. I take a few steps toward him.
Raikin?
He lifts his chin and drops his hands. His expression is a mixture of rage and relief. Dressed to kill, literally, he wears black everything, his moniker covered by his lead-lined glove, the outfit of someone ready to do murder. A shadow of a bruise mars his jaw. The muscles of his arms twitch. In a sword fight, we're equals. In hand-to-hand combat, I might not fare as well. Icy chills run down my spine.
Where have you been?
He asks in a low snarl. I haven't thought this part through. He can't know about Gabriel and Balmora. He'll kill my brother.
Is that a hard question?
His lip holds a sneer. Yes. I hate hearing the quiver in my voice.
Well, let's start with where you weren't. Maybe that's easier.
You weren't in the Neon Bible with Brisham. No, I reply breathlessly. I wasn't. He leans forward and reaches for a fat tumbler of amber liquor. Lifting the rim of the glass to his lips, he drinks all of it in one swallow. He sets it down and seizes a nearly empty diamond-shaped bottle, splashing more alcohol into his tumbler.
If that child you sent to me with your message hadn't delivered it when he did, I would have killed Grisham.
Why? My stomach twists with dread. I put out my hand and steady myself against the seat back of a chair.
My first impulse was that he arranged your kidnapping. I thought he let your mother's killers take you. Do you know what that feels like?
Raikin's jaw flexes. He looks as if he's ready to throttle me.
It should feel like nothing. You said you don't have a heart, that you don't care about me.
The rawness of my emotions chokes me. I blink away tears. Why does this man affect me so?
You should be more concerned about Grisham being assassinated by my mother than about what I'm doing. I can handle myself.
Raikin throws the glass against the wall. It shatters.
Haven't you figured it out yet?
He rises from his seat, seething.
You're the most important person. You. Not that ridiculous excuse for a man who thinks he should be the ruler of the world.
Tell me you didn't hurt Grisham. My knees grow weak.
No. I left him at the Neon Bible. I told him that I found you, but you were ill, and I had to take you home. In essence, I lied for you.
Nobody knows you were gone. I fixed it, like I always do. Anxiety like I've never known passes through me. I'm not a fan of Grisham, but it's not that. If Raikin were to kill Grisham, he'd be hunted down like no other man in the history of the world. He may not care about me, but apparently, I care about him. Enough to feel the crushing force of panic building. I wring my hands to try to get them to stop trembling. My breathing becomes heavier. Cold sweat develops on my skin. Raikin continues to rant at me, but I can hardly hear him over the pounding of blood in my ears. I turn away and, in a daze, hurry from the sitting room to the den where I put some chets away for an occasion such as this. It's dark when I enter. I stumble to the box on the table. Its clear wrapper crinkles when I try to unwrap one. The walls spin. I knock over the box. Why is this happening? I didn't feel an ounce of panic when I was fighting my way through a club full of assassins. But that was different. I was in control. It's the things I can't control, like Raikin, that turned me into a panting, shaking mess of heightened emotion.
I can't breathe.
Raiken stands in the doorway. The light in the room responds to his presence. Lamps turn on. He must have messed with it to irritate me. The room responds to him, but not me. Without Raiken, if I'm alone, I'll be in the dark. My hands become fists as I attempt to catch my breath. Raiken approaches me with his hand out warily, as if I might startle and run. I try to force myself to breathe slower, but I can't. He takes the chets from my fumbling fingers. Tearing off a piece of one, he holds it out to me, but when I reach for it, he pulls it back.
"Why should I give you this?" he asks. "You left me to panic for hours with no relief."
A flare of anger spikes. Dizziness turns to tunnel vision. Full-blown, merciless fear catapults my heart into a frenzy. I'm dying. My nails bite into my palms. Raiken swears softly. His fingers press the small piece of a chet to my lips. I take it into my mouth, and it melts on my tongue. My heart feels like someone is punching it. He touches my sleeve, smoothing his hand over my arm. I cringe at the ache it brings. I must be one enormous bruise from head to toe. I've compartmentalized my physical pain, and now an awareness of it roars to the forefront of my mind. The chet steadily dulls it, but I'm beyond sore in the places where I was shot. Raiken pummels me with a dark and brooding stare. I don't want to see his pity. He must think I'm weak and stupid. Why it matters to me what he thinks, I don't know. He's not my friend. He's barely my ally. His arm goes around my middle, tugging me to him. My back rests against his formidable chest. My head is heavy. He sweeps my damp hair away from my neck, baring my nape. "Shh," he whispers softly, soothing rather than scolding. The scent of whatever he was drinking mixes with his normal scent. It's sweet, and I turn toward his lips. His cheek skims the sensitive part of my throat. His hand brushes back my hair again. He pulls me to the sofa and tugs me down next to him, holding me to his chest. He covers me with a charcoal-colored cashmere blanket. My cheek rests against his neck. When normal breathing returns, I don't move. Exhausted, I lie limply against Raiken's side. "I'm sorry," he murmurs, grasping the bridge of his nose with his fingers, as if his head hurts and he can't find relief. The palm of his other hand rests on my side, one of the only places I'm not bruised beneath my white shirt. The crest of his knuckles is scabbing over. "Who have you been fighting?" I ask. My voice is hoarse. He lifts his hand, studying it.
"Where do you think I went when I couldn't find you?"
I wince. "I wasn't with Hawthorne."
"I know."
"Did you hurt him?"
"He's alive," Raiken replies grudgingly.
"What did you do?"
"We had a conversation, mostly with our fists. We stopped trying to beat each other senseless when it became obvious that neither one of us knew where you were."
"What did you two talk about?"
"That's between us."
"Did he say anything about joining our fight?" My voice is weak.
"No, we didn't talk about that. My only concern was finding you."
When I don't say anything, he sighs.
"Whose side are you on, Roselle?"
"My side."
"Were you with Salloway, the Rose Gardeners?" he asks. He sounds jealous.
"No."
"Then where were you?"
"Nowhere."
"You have to tell me. I'm going to lose my patience if you don't."
"Then lose it," I reply. "I'm not afraid of you."
"I think I'm the only person you're afraid of."
"Why would I be afraid of you?"
"Because you care about me," he says scornfully.
"That would make me stupid, Raiken."
"You care about what I think of you, and what I might do, and what might happen to me."
"You're delusional."
"Am I? I don't see you panicking around anyone else."
"That's because you're not paying attention."
"I couldn't be more attentive."
"How was I able to get away from you at the trial grounds, then, if you were so attentive?"
I sit up. His hand reaches out to stay me, but I'm beyond ready to end this conversation.